This week on Drive History, we're celebrating the launch of the Ford Mustang, check in on the Miata after 25 years, debate the purchase of a C4 Corvette, and go full frontal with a Citroën Traction Avant. All that and so much more coming your way right now.
It's time to cruise the highways and byways of the auto industry's past, present, and future. Join us in exploring the vehicles, people, events, and places that have shaped the way we move. This is the Drive History Podcast.
Welcome to episode 10 of the Drive History Podcast. I am Brian Corey, joined as always by Jordan Stead. And we are thrilled to be hitting the double digits. I did what you did last week. Somehow, some reason, that is the toughest word in the dictionary to say. Digits.
It's true. Also, I kind of feel like because we were celebrating so much on the ninth episode, I feel like we've overly celebrated now that we're into the double digits. So it feels like old news now.
It does, but alas, we're here, onward and upward, and I can't wait to be in triple digits.
Jumping ahead, I like it.
Come on. I'm looking at 4, 6, and we'll get there eventually. Speaking of news, though, quite a bit happening in the automotive world. You brought to my attention something a little interesting the other day. Why don't you give us a little overview of what Toyota's doing?
All right. So we got a lot of stuff going on here, but the most confusing and possibly cool thing going on is we've got four vehicles that have all been released very recently, and they all seem to be the same thing. And I know they're not, but it's worth pointing it out because I think there's a nuance here, and I think there's something that we could talk about in terms of why are these four vehicles hitting the market basically at the same time? And unless you're a super automotive nerd, what could the difference be between all of them? And you've got the Toyota Grand Highlander, the Toyota Land Cruiser, the Toyota 4Runner, which was just announced for the new gen last week, and the Lexus 550. And yes, there are like subtle differences between off-roading capabilities and engine power and interior features.
But stitching in the seats.
That's right. The big difference here is the fact the stitching between the seats is different. No, just kidding. But I guess what's most confusing to me, and the way I'm going to frame this up, is not as someone who knows a lot about cars and specs and tech, but more of someone who walks into a dealership and says, I want to buy a mid-size to large SUV. Sell me something. And my question is, how do you differentiate these things as a salesperson?
Well, that's why the salespeople get paid the big bucks.
I guess.
I mean, you're right. We were talking a while ago about how a lot of car companies are just focusing on singular vehicles for a whole
segment,
you know, be it SUV or sedan or whatever. And so, yeah, I'd see how it's interesting for Toyota, along with Lexus, to be putting out four of the exact same cars almost. But if you look at it from a broader perspective, like from a buyer power, I think there's probably a difference in the pricing that, you know, will elevate people to the next level. Like they might, if the entry car is the 4Runner and they're spending $40,000 on that and they graduate to the, what's the next one up? The Highlander or something?
I think it's Land Cruiser. This is the point. What I'm trying to get at is like, we don't even know, right? Like I've read about this and I'm like, okay, they're all Toyotas because don't forget Lexus owned by Toyota, right? So we're basically got four cars from Toyota overnight, all have a very similar wheelbase. They all look different and they all look cool, by the way, in my opinion. All four of them have a very fun look in their own way. But like they all offer very similar engines depending on the spec and how much you pay. But really at the end of the day, you're just on a sliding scale of the same engines. Sliding scale of size, which is not super different between all of them. Wheelbase, all very similar. And if you think about it, a very similar just type of vehicle, right? The midsize to large SUV. And maybe what this is coming down to is the crossovery true mid-size crossover world is so saturated, the only place for a car company to go is upmarket and bigger.
Totally. I mean, looking at it too, it seems like if there's two from Toyota, two from Lexus, the Lexus versions are just the luxury versions of the Toyota versions, but it seems nowadays, like, if you buy a new car, it's a luxury vehicle.
Yes.
Like, yes. Almost no matter what you buy.
Well, and that's what's confusing about this, because the Lexus 550, while quote unquote more luxurious, is like bested, in my opinion, if you look at the new 4Runner, very similar.
Yeah.
Super similar.
Yeah.
And I was looking at a Car and Driver article just before we started the podcast, and there's this side-by-side interior photo of both cockpits of, I think it was the Land Cruiser and 4Runner, and it's like indistinguishable, at least to like a general human eye. Unless you were looking for specific differences, looks exactly the same to me.
Sure. I gotta say though, the new redesign on the 4Runner is pretty sweet.
Yeah,
I'm feeling it. It's tough
for sure.
The rear roll down window is back.
True.
Which is probably true. The biggest part of the whole redesign.
That's right. That's worth $50,000 right there. Yeah. No, I agree. That's like one of the coolest things. The question is, new Tacoma or new 4Runner for you? Because from the front, if you were to stand in front of both of them, exactly the same. If you get any sort of a view of the side or back, different. What's your vibe?
Totally. And, you know, we talked about the SUV versus truck thing on the previous episode. And I really think it just comes down to, like, what are you going to use it for?
Yeah.
It's so weird to imagine a person buying a brand new truck and just, you know, putting it on a job site, throwing tools in it, dinging it and denting it. It's a $70,000 car and just treating it like it's a $1,500 pickup. For me personally, though, I think I would go with the Tacoma just from a usability standpoint. And I know that you have some views on this, but I haul, you know, landscaping dirt and bricks and things like that. And it just having that open air and ease of access to the bed is important to me, because they both carry five people. They both fit a dog. They both pull the same, have the same engine. Everything's the same. It's just having that bed access for me, I think, would do the trick.
I'm going to completely contradict myself from last episode, but between the two, I think I'm Tacoma with you as well. I like the way it looks more, at least from that simple fact.
Okay.
I like the Tacoma more. At least right now. We'll see when I see him, like, in real life. That's always the real test, right? Like, you see a photo of it, and you're like, oh, okay, cool. And then you see it in real life, you're like, okay, that looks awesome. Yeah.
Do you know if they're still doing a two-door or, like, a three-door Tacoma?
Oh, man, I should know this. Well, how about this? Not answering your question, but I believe there's 9 trims of the new 4Runner. And I think it's somewhat similar with the Tacoma.
Dang.
Which actually really takes us back to this initial question.
Why is there so much?
Okay, yeah, you've got a truck that looks just like an SUV.
Here it is.
Built in the same frame.
I just want the 4Runner, and I want the 1984 graphics package, and that's it.
Oh, don't you worry. It's coming.
Yeah.
It's always coming. But I mean, I mean, 9 trims on one vehicle is absolutely bonkers, especially in this day and age when... Really, what are you doing? You're doing 2 different engines, right? I believe it's the iForce Max and the non-iForce Max.
So, yeah, the standard powertrain is the 278 horsepower, and then there's a hybrid. That's 326.
Yeah. But, like, okay, so you got 2 engines spread across 9 trims. Some of the trims, the difference is literally, like, the suspension type on it.
Sure.
Which is, to me, seems crazy. I mean, I'm thinking as, like, a normal consumer. You walk in, the car you buy is the car you're going to have forever, right? But then I think about everybody who even has the slightest inclination to modify a vehicle. And it's like, you could swap the springs out on a truck and you have a totally different trim,
right?
Which is such a bizarre concept to me.
Well, I think it's interesting, like, what Ford did with the Bronco. It has a lot of trims too, like the Wildlands and the Badlands and the whatever. But I heard that the base model sold so much more because it is so highly customizable.
Yeah.
And I feel maybe that's a thing with Toyota, but there's not the, like, accessory packages that you can buy aftermarket for those cars. So you have to get it from the factory if you want to, like, get it to a point where you want it to, you know, be capable for whatever it is that you're doing in the woods or on the highway, wherever you drive your 4Runner. But oh, just one idea.
It's also, let's not forget, there's the cool guy tax.
Oh, for
like,
sure.
Like, Toyota has a cool guy tax.
You want matte black wheels? $20,000.
whatever it is, like you're paying a premium for whatever choice you make.
True.
Whereas I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm wrong here, but I feel like Ford on the list of like on the sliding scale of cool guy-ness, at least right now for me as a consumer, just from a distance, Toyota is way more cool guy than Ford is.
I mean, they've really accomplished a lot in terms of marketing Toyota to everyone. It's an outdoorsy brand. It's a commuter brand. It's a tough truck brand.
Reliability brand.
Right.
Work truck brand.
Right.
Yeah.
So anybody can walk into a Toyota dealership and leave with something that is going to suit their needs.
True. Then again, I don't think I've ever seen a Toyota Tacoma on a work site in my life. a Tundra, maybe, but yeah, I don't think I've ever seen a Tacoma on a work site.
Speaking of which, is there a new Tundra?
There is. Yeah. Actually, the Tundra was the first one out that led this whole new gen of all the following vehicles. Personally, I'm actually not a fan of the Tundra, at least in the way it looks. I think the last gen Tundra looks way better, but I do think this new gen of Tacomas and 4Runners sort of are awesome and look cool. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'd love any one of them, all of them, whatever, but it's an interesting place to be a consumer wondering what are you going to buy and walking into the dealership or whatever and going, okay, so everything is basically comparable. They just look differently. And so now is it really just like a lifestyle choice of like, what look do I want?
Right. Well, like I said, I want the 84 graphics package or I'll take that sandy color. I love that. Like,
yeah, there you go. Can't get wrong with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. A lot of options. A lot of options.
Spend wisely, folks.
Toyota, hit us up. Okay, let's dive into a little bit of history. We're going to roll through this pretty quick. There's a few really interesting things that happened this week, and I'm excited to talk about. So, let's get started. We're covering April 16th through the 22nd, and we're starting in 1991. Volkswagen acquires 70% of Skoda. Had to throw this in there because we were talking about Skoda last week. Marley actually found some photos from when she was a child with that car. I'll throw them up on the Soch. It was interesting. I was just reading about this. Skoda was the biggest company in the Czech Republic when Volkswagen acquired it. And now it owns it outright, I'm pretty sure.
Mm-hmm. So. Skoda is a brand that I wish we got here in the States. And because at least from what I know about Skoda is these days, they're kind of like they're a little bit of like a tuner's paradise.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, if you want an alternative to a GTI or you want like an alternative to like a fast wagon, like they have them in Europe and they're awesome. And people love them for the most part. And I wish we got them here in that same respect, because there's some really cool stuff. It's basically just like having an opportunity to have a different looking GTI.
That's
or
cool.
Golf R.
I wonder, you know, people import cars from Japan cause they're 25 years old now. Is there that same kind of market in Europe? Like, can we import cars that are 25 years old in Europe?
Dude, you are asking the question that I have actually always wondered, and we probably should look up before this episode.
Yeah,
I've probably. I've always wondered that. Like I obviously, Japanese car is so cool, blah, blah, blah. 25 years ago, everything was cool. But yeah, it's a great question. I don't know.
We'll find out. And if that's a thing, I'm starting a 25-year-old European car dealership.
That's right. We'll get back to you.
April 16th, 2002, MG celebrates its 1.5 millionth car ever built since production began in 1924. That's just crazy to me how low volume that is. 100 years almost, 80 years almost to make 1.5 million cars. Like, that's how many cars General Motors makes in a day.
It seems crazy until I think about how many times I've seen an MG in my life, and it's probably less than a dozen.
Sure, sure. The one that you probably have seen is the MGB, you know, little roadsters from the 70s and 80s.
Wow, thank you for this layup. I appreciate it. Guess what the first and coolest convertible I was in as a child?
An MGB.
MGB.
Look at that.
I think I might have mentioned this on like episode one or two. I grew up in Seattle, Washington, and next door, my neighbor's name was John, and he was a pilot. And he had, you know, he's obviously always on the go, but when he was home, one of his things was he would pull his like burnt orange MGB out into the driveway, convertible, beautiful car. I don't even know what year it was. And he would wash it and drive it around the neighborhood a couple times, and he'd park it back in his garage. And I must have been, I don't know, 8, 9 years old. And he saw me like peering over into his yard. And he's like, do you want to go for a ride in this? And my mom was like weeding or something nearby. I don't even know. Something like that.
This
and
explains a lot about your taste in cars.
I know. It really does now that I'm saying this a lot. But I was like psyched. Couldn't believe he was asking. My mom's like, yeah, go ahead. And I remember this ride in this car so clearly. And it was like a beautiful blue day in Seattle. It must have been maybe spring, summer. And he was just like ripping around this little,
top
you know,
down, I'm
sure. Yeah, top down, just wind in the hair for the first time ever as a human being.
Wow.
I remember this ride so clearly. And
I know what I'm going to get you for your birthday.
Oh God. but all the other 11 times I've seen an MGB in my life, I'm like, yeah, that's cool. I remember that ride, but I really haven't thought a whole lot about it.
Well, you know, my old kit car, I had that MGTD Volkswagen kit car. So that was as close as I have ever gotten to owning or driving an actual MG.
Do the listeners know about that car? You should tell them. Give them the 20-second overview of that car.
Yeah, I had a 1952 MGTD kit car built on a 1970 Volkswagen Pan. It's brown on brown on brown, which was pretty sweet.
Poop spec. Love it.
Yeah. You know, little 1600cc, 4-speed. It banged. It was fun to drive. It was slow, but it ripped, if that makes sense.
It does.
You got in there, right?
Yeah.
But sold it recently to a guy who was buying it to surprise his wife, which I don't know if was a good idea.
Yeah, I was going to say, surprise, your shit's fucked up.
Yeah. One other thing about MG, my aunt actually just tried to pass off a poster of a MG ad for that car. And on that note, I just had to shout out to the Port Gardner Vintage Auto Club because we went down and talked to them. My aunt and uncle, Mary and Roy, they're in the club, have been for decades. And so we had the opportunity to go mingle with a few car folk, and that was pretty fun. So
it was.
Shout out to them.
Yes, shout out. Thank you guys for the invite. It was a lot of fun to come down.
Heck yeah. April 16th, 2014, Mazda celebrates the 25th anniversary of the MX-5 Miata with a special anniversary edition, which debuted to the press at the New York Auto Show.
Yes.
I know you're a Miata guy. Well, would you still consider yourself a Miata guy? What year was yours? Give us the rundown.
It was a 95 NA, 5-speed, base model, no AC, which I found out after I bought it.
The AC is just taking the top off.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I tried to tell myself after I realized that. Yeah, manual locks, manual windows, all the things. I never thought that I would buy a Miata. And then, of course, I was like, well, how can I call myself a true car enthusiast without at least driving or owning a Miata at some point? And so next thing you know, you're on Craigslist, you're on Facebook Marketplace.
I know all too well.
Yeah. You think you see a deal. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. I don't know. And then you jump on it. Ultimately, it was a deal. It was a great buy.
That was a great buy.
Brian was there with me, actually came out to test drive it, and I bought it on site at the same time, which is actually a really cool experience to know that like we've obviously, we're on the podcast together. We're friends, but that was like a very cool car person moment to have together. But I knew that it was one of those things where I was buying it because I really just wanted to say that I had had a Miata.
I have a Miata.
Yeah, like I've experienced the Miata thing. I've done the Miata.
And then you wanted to go drive it through some cones.
Yes, I did, and I did drive it through some cones.
I bet you did.
Some autocross life, but anyway. Yeah, really special. So fun. I mean, if you ever get a chance to drive a Miata of any year, of any type, please do. Really, it really, truly is a special experience.
I feel like they're going to be making that car forever.
Yeah, and if they don't, it would be a huge mistake.
Totally.
Because everyone's going to buy them.
Right.
Always.
There's nothing else like it on the road, really.
And there's nothing else near its price point either. So, well, there is, but it's not a Miata. But still, anyway, you know, between that and a BRZ and what else? I mean, at end of the day, we're all talking about these cars like they're these new special things, when in actuality, they're just living classics. Right? Yeah.
Jumping forward to April 17th, 1964, the Ford Mustang officially debuts at the New York World's Fair. We're celebrating the 60th anniversary of Ford Mustang on this day. Pretty iconic vehicle. You know, when it first came out, it was a smashing hit. with a base price of just $2,368, which is wild. I mean, like we were talking about the other day, Gail Weiss, she bought the first one. That's how she could afford it, on a teacher's salary. But when it first came out, coupe or convertible, the Fastback would come a few months later.
By the way, my mom, this is one of those facts where next episode I'll get back to you, but I might be completely lying when I tell you this next thing, or it could be totally true. But I think the sands of time have like just erased whether or not it's true for me in my mind. My mom has crashed two Fastback Mustangs from that era.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's like she owned two of them and crashed two of them, and one of them was in a tunnel in Seattle.
Oh my, is she okay?
Yeah, she's fine. I mean, she's not a fast driver at all these days, which is totally fine. But I think I either am completely making that fact up, or she told me that at one point and my brain is just romanticizing the idea. But I'll get back to y'all. But I'm pretty sure she had two of them and crashed both of them.
Wow.
Yeah.
My dad had a Mustang from that era that I believe he sold to his best friend, and it had such bad rust you could put your foot through the floor.
Nice.
Yeah.
Flintstone style.
Flintstone Mustang. I had a Mustang. I had a 94, but it was just a V6.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
What color?
It's like forest green, dark green. Nice. Put some American Racing wheels on it. That was
yeah,
all.
Yeah, he did.
Did nothing else to it but drive it. Couple other tidbits on the Mustang before we jump ahead. It could be had with, when it was new, with a variety of engines ranging from 170 cubic inch inline six up to the 289 V8. And it was based on the Ford Falcon platform, which was an idea championed by Lee Iacocca to make it affordable. Ford was just coming off the Edsel debacle, which was a brand of cars that was supposed to kind of slot in between Ford and Lincoln. It was a complete flop. They lost like billions of dollars, you know, equivalently to today's money. And so Henry Ford II, who was the president at the time, was like very skeptical of doing anything new. He's like, nope, we're just going to sell sedans and trucks and be a boring car company. But Lee Iacocca, recognizing that there was nothing really else like the Mustang on the market, said, we can do this cheap. And that really all it was putting a cool body on a cheap car.
Right.
And it sold like hotcakes. They sold a million of them the first year.
I mean, you see that all the time now.
Yeah, right? Totally.
All the time. And if I'm not mistaken, our friend Carrie, who we've mentioned 1,000 times in this podcast and still not featured yet, I'm pretty sure in the new Mustangs, so they used to have a turbo four, a six cylinder, non-turbo, and then the V8.
Mm-hmm.
And the turbo four got so fast that they've phased out the six. And so all you can buy a Mustang in now is a turbo four or a V8, which I believe is the case for the new gen.
I think.
Either or, I think it's really interesting that you can like drive around in a Mustang, and unless you're very keenly aware of badges and the things on the car,
right?
Like you just, you know, you see it and you go, oh, it's a Mustang, right?
Well, that's what Ford's doing with the 60th anniversary. There's actually an update. Current Ford Mustang owners, if your car can get over the air updates, you can basically download a 60th anniversary like edition, like for your dash or something like that.
What?
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, like pretty, retro gauges or something?
Yeah. Okay. Something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty wild. On the heels of the Mustang, April 17th, 1969, Ford then introduced the Maverick, which was a compact car. It could be had as a two or four door sedan or a wagon, and did not have the same kind of success that the Mustang did. It would go out of production in 1977. But as you know, the Maverick is back in a completely new form, and I still kind of want one.
Yeah, how mad are you right now that you don't have one?
I'm pretty disappointed. I put in an order for one, you know, COVID years, and it just never got fulfilled. I never paid anything for it, but I was expecting to get one. And it was when the base model price was like $19.99 or whatever, sub $20,000. And so I was like, I'm getting a cheap new hybrid truck that gets, you know, 40 miles per gallon and does whatever I need it to do. And I never got it.
Did that ever come true? Did they actually sell $19,000 versions of it?
Yeah, like landed with, whatever they call the shipping costs, it's like 21 right. something. But yeah, I mean, it was cheap. And then people were flipping them like crazy.
Yeah.
So never happened, and I'm bitter, and now I'm just waiting for Subaru to come out with a new Baja.
Hey, man, I mean, now's the time. Like, we got the, whatever that Hyundai, I always forget, what's the new one? The truck, Santa Cruz? Oh,
the Santa Cruz, Santa yeah. Cruz. Yeah, it's pretty good.
Basically a Baja.
It is basically a Baja.
Yeah.
Okay. April 18th, 1934, Citroën debuts the Traction Avant, which was the first like mass-produced front-wheel drive vehicle in Europe. It's kind of interesting that front-wheel drive took so long to become kind of standard. But it's
yeah.
Like, you know, you go to the lot and most cars these days are front-wheel drive. But Citroën was on top of it back in the day.
Look, I have a weird partial interest in front-wheel drive cars. Look, I'll say it publicly. I have not driven enough rear-wheel drive cars and had enough fun in rear-wheel drive cars to really feel like it's the thing that I love the most. I like an all-wheel drive car just for the stability and like whatever, and that's kind of all the rage these days, especially with performance. But if you can move past the whole like wrong wheel drive when referring to front wheel drive cars, which I think is totally moot by now in car history, there's so many good front wheel drive cars. Like think True. About the Civic Type R. Like, True. It's literally like lap setting, time setting, gold standard of like rad performance car in that respect of that class.
Yeah.
Incredible. Always has been, right?
Yeah.
I love them. I think they're great. And I appreciate the stability or the type of stability that you get in a front wheel drive car.
Totally.
Like when I had my Abarth, I pushed that car, I would literally say 10 times harder than I ever pushed my Miata, just because of the characteristics of what I understood and felt about the car, sure. as opposed to a,
it's a completely drive different driving experience.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think basically the moral of the story is I never have truly beat on a rear wheel drive car in the same way that I've beat on a front wheel drive car.
Sounds like you need to get a big V8 muscle car.
So
go do some burnouts.
Yes and no is the point. Like, I agree, but also like the last thing I think I probably need if I'm going to beat on a rear-wheel drive car is more power. But God. I hear you. Yeah, I know.
Speaking of power, April 18th, 1964, the Ford GT40 makes its track debut at Le Mans. It had just debuted a couple weeks before that at the New York Auto Show. But this is, you know, the iconic car. Everybody knows it from Ford versus Ferrari.
For sure.
Ford built it solely to beat Ferrari at Le Mans, and it did so multiple times in grand style.
Love it.
That would be a fun car to get behind the wheel of.
Totally. Hatred and revenge is a powerful tool.
Truth. Truth. April 19th, 1979. Speaking of front wheel drive, Chevrolet begins production of its first mass produced front wheel drive car, the Citation. So I put this in here knowing we were just going to be talking about front wheel drive. Not that the Citation's an exciting car, but to illustrate that it wasn't really a option for most people, until almost 1980, you know. Yeah. There was a couple other front-wheel drive vehicles on the road, but I don't know, like you're talking about, like, the benefits of the stability. Like, I think that it's true because you have all the weight, you know, in the front, and so to be able to power those wheels just yep. keeps you locked on the road a little better.
Well, if you're in a wet or snowy environment too, front-wheel drive car all day, every day.
Right.
Right? And, like, we live in Washington, you know, it's like, I never worried about driving in the snow with like my old Fiat.
Right.
But in a Miata, hell no. Right. Like, that thing's staying in the garage. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm sure there's a parking lot somewhere that really could have enjoyed the fruits of my...
A little bit.
Yeah, totally. But anyway, yeah.
So...
Also, can we talk about the who names a car the Citation?
Well, you're not getting a Citation in that thing.
Yeah, okay, that's true. If you were to name a fast car a Citation, the level of memeing is just so high.
That's true. What a goofy name.
Yeah, it's really stupid. Like, in on its best day, what does it even mean, right?
Right.
Like, oh, wow, what'd you get? Oh, I got the new Citation. What does that even mean? There's no upside to this. Right. Nothing about that's cool.
It's just... letter play. I don't know.
I guess. Jesus.
Here's a cool car.
Yep.
April 2005, a Bugatti Veyron. Is that how you say it? Veyron? Veyron?
Veyron? Yeah.
Yeah. Hits a top speed of 253.8 miles per hour, making it the fastest production car to date.
I got nothing to say, man.
Have you ever seen the video of the Veyron driving into the lake?
No, but I feel like I should. Yeah. Wow.
You should probably just look it up. It's crazy. Like, somebody's just, like, filming one going down the freeway or something, and then it just veers off into the lake. It's crazy.
I also just love the sheer level of zero fucks given when developing a W16 engine with four turbos on it.
See, you do have something to say about this. I knew you would.
That's all I have to say. It's just like, hey, what does everybody else have? Well, at this point, pretty much just like a V8's as big as it's going to get. Cool. How many turbos does everyone put on it? Two. Cool. Let's what if we doubled all of that?
Including the top speed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, man. It's just totally ridiculous. Have you ever heard one of those engines?
I don't think so.
You got to YouTube it, man. Yeah. I mean, it sounds...
Well, I mean, yeah, I've seen it online.
But yeah.
I don't think I've seen one of these cars in person.
I've seen one parked. I think I've seen one parked at some, you know, museum or something. But yeah, I've never seen one moving. Bugatti just released basically a Gen 2 of that engine. Right.
Oh.
Just recently.
Oh, okay.
Because they used that similar engine, that Gen 1, in all sorts of the Bugattis in the last like 10 something years. And they just released a Gen 2. But yeah, that Gen 1 with the four turbos on it, like the sound of it is just... It's like, doesn't make sense when you're listening to it. And I can't even imagine inside the cabin of one of those vehicles.
Well, if I remember right, it was like a 1,000 horsepower car, right?
I think more.
Pretty close.
I think more, yeah.
But there was a key to unlock, like a literal key.
Right.
That you could unlock like the extra power. Like you could just drive around with 400 horsepower and then turn this other key and get 1,000 horsepower or whatever it was. Yeah.
Which actually makes a lot of sense. Right?
Totally.
Like the more you think about it, it's like, okay, you're going to give it to your, you know, idiot friend or whatever. Not that you would, but I'm going to limit you to 400 horsepower, yeah, right? The low number. But then when I drive it, I'm going to drive the 1200 horsepower. Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure probably everyone listening to this podcast has heard a Bugatti engine sound or whatever. But if you haven't, Google it. YouTube it's insane. Like I can't even imagine what it would be like to be in that cabin and four turbos spooling up. Whee. And yeah, it's just nutty. Anyway, so cool.
420, bro. April 20th, 2000, Lexus announces its first convertible, the SC430.
Convertible. Did it launch as the hardtop at the same time? I would assume.
I could not tell you, but that makes sense.
430 sick, man. That was a sick Lexus V8 classic.
Yeah. So Lexus, what, came out in like 89? It's kind of surprising as a luxury brand to not have a convertible option.
True.
For 10 years.
Yeah, especially because at least in my head, the 90s felt like such a convertible decade.
Right. God, I want an E36, man.
Time is now. Mm-hmm. 430 has always been cool. Also, one of those cars that falls into my, like, the chunk of my brain that says timeless design.
True.
They look so good.
True.
They still look good. Apparently, they drive amazingly, super smooth.
It's a Toyota.
Yeah, they're awesome.
What is also a Toyota is the Scion FRS. The concept debuted on April 20th, 2011. Leading to a production version in 2012 with its co-vehicle, the Subaru BRZ. We talk about this car like a lot.
Literally every episode.
So we're just going to cruise on.
Yep.
And...
Do you think they timed the 420 release for like Subaru vaping like smokers? Were they like making a meme? Were they making a meme out of that?
Probably. I mean, like that's their target audience, right?
I guess.
Man. April 21st, 1983. The 1984 Chevrolet Corvette is introduced. It's the first time that the Corvette has been completely restyled since 1968. So this is the introduction of the C4. Interestingly, there was no 1983 Chevrolet Corvette. Actually, I take it back. There was one produced, and it was still from the C3 generation.
Mm.
But I guess just like from a retooling perspective or whatever it was, they just like shut down all the factories. They made one VIN 1983 Corvette. Weird. Which is in the National Corvette Museum. Anyway, C4 Corvette, I'm kind of on that boat. I know you're pushing me hard to get into something quote unquote fast, but
it's funny you put this in, because I feel like you're now falling into my trap. Like, just the fact that you put this in here, I'm like, oh, Brian's thinking about it.
It's true.
Look, it's true. Listen, if you'll do one thing today, spam the email, which is
contact@carsandcopymedia.com.
Spam the email, spam the socials, and say, Brian, stop being a wuss. Buy a car newer than 1990 that has more than 180 horsepower and is fun and fast and cool and has potential to be modded and is just cool in general. Just spam it. Spam it. The man needs a push. He needs a push.
Is 1988 okay with you?
Look, if it's a Corvette, yes. Anything else, no.
Sorry, can't get the 98 or 88 911 now, that's, I guess.
Right. Yeah. Exactly, yes.
All right, well, we'll see what happens. I just got to sell this Subaru I got parked out front first.
That's right, Subaru Baja for sale 2004?
Six.
Turbo
auto.
Look at that, boom.
135,000 miles.
That's great.
It's pretty good.
35,000 miles is what he meant to say. Yeah. 35,000 miles, mint condition.
It's perfect.
Yeah, it's gonna be great. Buy it.
Email me. Speaking of Corvette, April 21st, 1996, the father of the Corvette, Zora Arkus Duntov, does he really championed the Corvette in the 1950s, was the reason that it still exists to this day, because he's the one that basically shoved a V8 under the hood finally, because when it first came out you could only get it with an inline six. So rip Zora.
Here's a question that I could know the answer to if I used the internet.
What's the internet?
Yeah, that's right. His name is Zora. He's 86 when he dies in 96, right?
Right.
I wonder if, and this could be the dumbest question ever, is the Z package on Corvettes based off of Zora, his first name? Z71?
Yeah, you're right.
Z06?
Z06.
Whatever all the cool Z-ish packages on the Corvette. I wonder if it's based off of Zora.
That's a great question. I would not be surprised, but it could also be something totally obscure. But
yeah.
I would like to pretend it is.
Yeah, me too, actually. That's what I was going to say. I feel like they owe it to our man here.
Totally.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
Ah, good catch on that.
Just wondering. I mean, Zora is such a weird name that I was like, there's not a lot of Z shit going on probably in the Chevy world. So to have the guy who is the father of the Corvette have a Z name and then have a Z trim level situation going on seems awfully coincidental.
That's true.
Yeah.
I'm going to ponder that like a true crime podcast.
Yeah.
April 21st, 2011, Fiat announces a deal to purchase another 16% share of Chrysler, making it the majority shareholder. So one of the big three is now, at that point, a European-owned company. You had a Fiat. You talked about hauling your dog around in it a lot. I would like to know, what are your specifications for a dog hauler?
Okay. It's actually a really good thing I feel like we should talk about in general. A lot of people have dogs. A lot of people have cars. A lot of people like cars. A lot of people want to keep their dog, but they want to have a cool car. Okay, so I guess it depends on your dog, right?
Sure.
If you've got a 6-pound lap dog chihuahua, you're fair game. You're fair game. Yeah, you can drive whatever you want to drive. Like, good for you. I've got a 75-pound pit bull who is a total wuss and needs extreme luxury. So, okay, here's the biggest wrestle for me.
Oh,
indeed. I want a trunk, right? I want an open trunk, like in, let's say, my piece of shit Forester that I have right now, right? It's the best of all worlds. I have a wagon. I can store a bunch of stuff. I can still drive a car with five people in it, but I also still have a pretty ample spot for a dog.
Right.
You know, it's like a fishbowl in there, so he can see out wherever. I can still pull the thing to cover the back area when he's not in there.
Right.
All the things. But maybe it's just because I'm a car person, but I have a hard time saying it's just as possible that I could buy a sedan and put a dog in the back seat. because there's something weird about like putting a dog on a back seat and having them kind of free roam around the car. Like you hit the red light, you slam on the brakes, your dog goes flying. I don't know. I don't like that feeling. I don't want to like hurt him or whatever. But it's totally possible.
Well, dogs have this all the time. Dogs have terrible like stance in a vehicle.
And he's an idiot.
In general.
He's beautiful.
Not just your dog.
Yeah. True. He's dumb as shit, but he's beautiful. But yeah, he just doesn't understand how gravity and stuff works. So like I would love to be driving around again, like an S5 coupe from 10 years ago and, you know, flooring it everywhere I went and throwing my dog in the back. But I just know he's going to be bouncing around back there like a pinball. And it's just not going to be good for me or for him. And so that's why I drive this piece of shit Forester right now, because I can just throw him in the back and he's back there comfortably.
There you go. Our dog, he chills. Like on car rides, he just lays down.
Yeah.
Because I got the Baja and then we got my wife's car and she just has a little Hyundai accent and we got the dog cover for the back seat. And he just goes back there and just like lays down. Like he's not a like stare out the window type of dog.
So see, that's the difference between us.
Yeah.
Indy never.
He'll pop up, perk out, whatever. But like, Once we're on the road, he's out.
Indy will never lay down in a car. And the only time he will is after we've ripped him at a dog park for like an entire calendar month.
Yeah.
And then he gets in the car, and if we're driving in a straight line long enough and he thinks that the threat of turns is gone, he'll slowly lay down in the back. But if I turn the wheel ever so slightly, his dumb fucking head pops up.
Where are we going?
Yeah, he's like, what's going on? What's going on? And then it's over. And so I'm like, I feel like just maybe my like empathetic soul is like, this dog needs to have some semblance of space beyond a back seat. But it's a great question. I don't know, man. I need help.
Well, my brother, when he moved to Chicago like 12 years ago or something, he had a Nissan pickup truck.
Yeah.
And all his stuff was in the back. And he has a dog. And it's one bench seat in the front, and it was my brother, the dog, and me, and it's a stick shift.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're driving this four banger, chock full of everything, and my brother's life in the bed.
Yep.
It's whatever, 60 pound big dog. And that dog is also not a sit down dog. And he was just walking back and forth for 4 days across our life.
Yeah. It's not rad.
Yeah. But it's sweet. But I think you're onto something with the wagon. I'm just a big fan of wagons in general, so you can do so much with them.
We're going to do a wagon episode in the future. I decree it.
Yeah.
We're going to do it. And I think that the topic of this wagon episode, I'm also decreeing this live on air. Brian doesn't know this, but we're going to do this wagon episode. And I want the subject of this future episode to be about, are wagons actually cool? Or are they a thing that people think they're cool because other people say they're cool if you're into cars? You know what I mean? Like if you read any automotive anything in the past 30 plus years, every automotive writer is like, the peak coolness is a wagon. And I feel like people who read all those things, AKA all of us, you know, slowly but surely begin to believe this repeated thing over and over, right? We've read it for years and years. Are wagons actually that cool?
Yes.
Well, yes, I think so too. But why?
Right.
And is this actually true? Or are we just parroting what other people think are cool, who are automotive writers and journalists and quote unquote professionals who believe that they understand cars the most? Anyway, more later. It's going to be a future episode, but it's something I thought about the other day. I was like, is this actually true? Or are we all just lying to ourselves?
I lie to myself about a lot of things, but the fact that wagons are cool is not one of them.
Yeah, good point. I agree. I totally agree. Yeah.
No, but I want to get into this, and I think that we need to bring in some experts or something.
Totally. We need a wagon expert.
Yeah.
But I mean, I guess I don't know what the answer is to your question.
I mean, they have wagon fests. Like there's just like such a cult following.
But would wagon fests exist if automotive writers hadn't talked about them and fetishized them for the past 30 years?
Same question.
I don't know.
I don't know.
But the real question is,
I don't know, because I don't like, I read stuff, but I like, I've just always been drawn to the wagon. I'm into obscure vehicles in general. And so like my 8-passenger Mercury Sable wagon was like a dream come true for me.
Yeah.
But that's a good question.
I want to explore it because I think like if we really attack it psychiatrically, we could probably get at something.
For sure.
But to answer your question, I don't have an answer. I think maybe we ask the audience this. Like, what is the best dog hauling car that is fun to drive, whether there's a dog in it or not, and doesn't compromise on utility. Mega bonus points if you can have it in a manual. Mega bonus points if it has a turbo or a supercharger that you can tune for more power.
is this really for the dog or is this for you?
I mean, yeah, it's for me, okay? It's for me. But like the dog is, you know, ultimately the one that's pushing me to buy this piece of shit, right? So anyway, weighing in, listeners, we need your help because Brian and I are tired. We're exhausted. Our bank accounts are drained. We're burning through all these pieces of shit cars trying to find the perfect one-off solution.
So true.
And maybe the answer is we just need to make more money and buy multiple cars. But I don't know. Anyway, we'll figure that out later. What's up next?
I was checking to see if we had any messages. Not yet.
Nothing? All quiet?
All quiet on the Western Front.
Damn.
April 22nd, 1870, Mitsubishi is founded. This is interesting because it was founded as a steamship delivery company, basically a mail carrier. And the guy who founded it bought three like old boats to deliver mail.
They didn't make an Evo in 1870?
No.
Damn.
Could you imagine?
Actually, maybe there's like a steamboat out there that's like an Evo. Right. Really Evo steamboat.
Well, did you know? Similar but different. The boat that just crashed in Baltimore was a Hyundai.
That's the dumbest shit I've ever said in this podcast, by the way. An Evo steamboat.
All right, Mark Twain. But the boat that crashed in into the bridge in Baltimore was built by Hyundai, I believe, or the mechanicals of it.
Really?
So I did not know. I knew that they did industrial stuff. I didn't know it was to that scale. But yeah, Mitsubishi was founded in 1870 as a steamship company. They wouldn't build their first car until 1917. So it's one of the oldest Japanese automakers out there.
Had no idea. Didn't know. I had no idea it was that old.
It's old as dirt.
Yeah, I guess.
All right. Thought we'd end this history section on a earth-friendly note.
Mm.
April 22nd, 1970, citing environmental concerns, many attributed to automobile pollution, the first Earth Day is held in the United States as created by Senator Gaylord Nelson. I don't know, just kind of a fun fact.
Yeah.
And it was like an early look at emissions controls because in the years that followed, that's when you would see like the gas crisis, right, but also like catalytic converters and all the things that made cars less fun. So thanks a lot, Gaylord. You ruined everything.
No. Also, here's the hot take you've been waiting for here, Brian, yes, the whole episode. I've had a number of people over the years be like, man, I got my catalytic converter stolen off my car. Someone cut it off my car. You know, particularly Prius drivers.
Right.
Up here in Bellingham, especially. We got a bunch of Prius drivers. And my neighbor who had one was like, yeah, catalytic converter got cut off. You know, it was such a pain in the ass. I was like, listen, you clearly are not a car person because just they just did you a favor. Okay. It sounds so much cooler now and it was free for you.
And somebody that needed something to eat got a few extra bucks.
Exactly. They got some precious earth metals and they hawked that for a McChicken.
It's not a bad trade.
That's true. We got a little listener mail. Shout out Michael G. Thank you for the note. Follow in this man's footsteps. Send us notes. Send us emails. Blast us on social. Send us hate mail. All the things. Brian, take us away. What does Michael have to say?
I recently forwarded story content celebrating the 100th anniversary of the first Chrysler car. So I wanted to see what your thoughts were, knowing that Walter P. Chrysler would have been 149 years on the 2nd of April, having been born in 1875. It is my understanding that the Chrysler Corporation is planning a major anniversary at Carlisle, Pennsylvania, in July of next year. It's unfortunate that the recognition of the history associated with the first Chrysler car has been mostly overlooked. So, just to set a little bit of history straight here, the first car with the Chrysler name came out in January of 1924, I believe. But it was actually a Maxwell Chrysler. Walter P. Chrysler, we actually went over this in a previous episode, had made a ton of money working in the auto industry. He purchased Maxwell to essentially try to save it. And by the way that he did that was by putting his name on a car. The next year, he actually reorganized Maxwell into the Chrysler Corporation in 1925. So I think your dismay in not seeing a celebration for the first car will actually take place next year on the official anniversary, 100th anniversary of the founding of Chrysler as a brand. So I'm with you. And I didn't put this in our notes here, but he is displaying a car at an early Chrysler at a Concours event this summer. So there will be a celebration, Michael. Don't worry. It's coming.
Redemption is coming.
Redemption is coming.
Love it. Wow. Thank you, Michael. Appreciate the note. Thanks to you all for listening. Appreciate your patience, bearing with us. We're 10 episodes in, y'all. We're double digits. Thank you. This is that moment. If you haven't done it yet, please rate us, you know, 1-star, 2-star, 3-star, 4-star, but particularly 5-star. If you like our shit, wherever you're listening to us, please like it.
If you give us 1-star, I'm going to come find you.
That's true. Don't do that. Brian is a violent man. But most importantly, please share. We're at a very interesting time right now where, you know, our friends and family and our friends of our family are listening and enjoying this. But every share is important, and we appreciate your support. If you like what you hear, if you just hate us endlessly, please continue to hate, share, love, share, do what you got to do. But thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.
Until then, drive history every day.
Bye.